Perhaps you're traveling, or perhaps you've moved into a new area. It's Sabbath morning, and you drive out to a church. You approach the church parking lot and notice how immaculately clean, neat, and modern everything looks. It's a nice, big structure with beautiful stained glass windows. You enter the parking lot and see lots of shiny, clean, late model vehicles. You see families and individuals making their way into church. You park, get out of the car, and make your way up the steps towards the front door. You're greeted by a couple of well-dressed greeters who welcome you to the church and hand you a nice, thick, colorful, glossy bulletin. One of them guides you to the guest book, which you do sign, and the greeter returns to her post. You take several steps away wondering, well, where to go next? What do I do next? You look around wondering if there might be someone you could ask. Everyone seems to be in such a hurry. No one seems to really have the time to stop. You finally manage to flag down a passing gentleman and ask where Sabbath school classes are held. He quickly motions you towards the hallway and tells you to go down and turn to the left and then go three doors down to the right. He apologizes that he isn't able to personally take you there because he still needs to get set up the youth Sabbath school program. So you make your way down the hallway, turn to the left, and then count three doors to the right. You look inside and see that there are chairs set up, but no one inside. Not knowing what else to do, you enter the room and take a seat to the left, four chairs down so that you can see if someone else enters in. And to let someone know that, you know, someone passing by, that there's a visitor in class today. 5 minutes later, a couple enters in, followed by a few more members. They greet you, ask about where you're from, and you tell them that you've moved to the area recently. They welcome you to town and ask how you're liking it. And then they begin to talk about the latest goings on in the church amongst themselves. After a few more minutes, the teacher walks in and the class begins. The class is more lecture style, and there's very little in the way of interaction. Everyone just seems to sit there quietly, nod in agreement every so often, and the teacher just goes on. As the class ends and everyone gets up to leave, a few of the members thank you for coming and say that they hope to see you again soon. You follow the departing class members towards the sanctuary for worship time. And there are groups in the hall and the foyer, milling about, talking amongst themselves. You make your way into the sanctuary and take a seat on one of the side pews, five from the back. And you watch as people filter in and the announcements are made. Looking around you, you estimate that the room could hold 200 or 300, and it seems to be about three-quarters full. The order of service is quite recognizable as typically Adventist. There's singing towards the beginning, a few prayers, the offering is taken, a children's story, a special music, scripture reading, then the sermon. A few teens straggling in take a few spaces on the other end of the pew on which you sit. Then the sermon is followed by another song, and then a benediction. Throughout the service, you glance around to see what is going on and note that everything is happening up front. Everyone in the congregation appears to be staring intently up at the front of the church. And following the benediction, you get up and slowly make your way out of the sanctuary and out of the building. A few people look towards you but make no attempt to approach or say anything. And so you make your way out of the building, into the parking lot, to your car. You unlock it, open the door, you get in it, close the door, start the engine, back out, drive away. As you drive away, you ask yourself, will I return? Should I return? Have you ever been there? You've gone to church but leave thinking it might have been better if you hadn't. Or you've gone expecting a certain experience, but you leave unfulfilled. Whatever it is that you had hoped for, it wasn't there during that time called worship. whatever it was, to you anyway, it seemed more like a staged play, a performance. What is worship, really? Is worship something we do to get some preconceived result? Or should we expect a certain experience and feelings from worship? Is worship something we do at a set time, in a predefined location, using a set of prescribed forms? What is worship? We continue our journey through the Gospel according to John. Today we look into chapter 4. I'm going to reverse the order in which we typically examine our text by focusing on the topic of worship in verses 19 through 26. And then, probably next week, we'll look at the overall story of the woman at the well. The woman had asked Jesus a question during their discourse. This is verse 20. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, speaking of Mount Gerizim. But you say that in Jerusalem is the place where people ought to worship. Jesus' response to the woman was, Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We worship what we know, for salvation is from the Jews. And then Jesus continues in his response, part of which we read during the scripture reading this morning. But the hour is coming and is now here when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. For the Father is seeking such people to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth. Or as the Message translation puts it, this is verses 23 and 24 together again. But the time is coming, and it has in fact come, when what you're called will not matter, and where you go to worship will not matter. It's who you are and the way you live that counts before God. Your worship must engage your spirit in the pursuit of truth. That's the kind of people the Father is out looking for, those who are simply and honestly themselves before him in their worship. God is sheer being itself, spirit. Those who worship him must do it out of their very being, their spirits, their true selves, in adoration. The woman's question about the proper location of worship implies in it much more than just a question about the location. It implies a whole history of proper worship that stretches back centuries and even millennia in their history. It includes and goes beyond the return of the Jews from the exile in Babylon. It includes and goes beyond the split of the Israelite kingdoms into north and south, to the reign of Solomon and to the reign of David, when the Ark of Covenant had not yet been in Jerusalem, to when the Israelites worshipped on Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim after entering Canaan, back to the wilderness sanctuary, to Jacob and to Isaac, and all the way back to Abraham. Many cultures in the ancient world believed that their god or gods were local to particular areas based on the presence of the god's worshippers. Within these areas were specific places that held special significance, often because of some supernatural occurrence attributed to that god. These were not only places that had historical significance, but they were places where one came, or actually had to come, in order to seek their god or gods. These were places where they believed their god or gods literally dwelt. The Jews and the Samaritans, to a high degree, appeared to have also held this belief. The Jews believed that for the worship of Yahweh, Jerusalem was the most important and sacred location. On the other hand, the Samaritans believed that Mount Gerizim, near Jacob's well, which is the well where the woman met Jesus, was the place where Yahweh dwelt. Jacob's well was at the ancient city of Shechem, a place where Abraham first settled in Canaan, and where Jacob returned to after his exile in Haran. And this was where Joseph's body was buried after the Exodus. So in a very special way, it goes, in Israelite history, it goes back to the very roots, their very beginnings of their history, and so it was considered a sacred spot for them. Mount Gerizim was where the blessings were pronounced upon Israel's entry into Canaan. You can read that in the book of Joshua. On the other hand, Jerusalem became a holy site much later, during the reign of David. So according to the older is better tradition of the Jews and Samaritans, Mount Gerizim, to the Samaritans anyway, was more sacred than Jerusalem. Jesus, because he was perceived to be a prophet, was called upon by this woman to settle the question once and for all. The answer would also settle which forms of worship were more acceptable to God. Was it the supposedly more pure worship forms observed by the Jews in Jerusalem, the worship forms that came about due to their exile in Babylon? Or was it the worship forms observed by the Samaritans, the ones that were passed on and handed down from Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, through the Exodus, through the times of the prophets and kings, through their dispersion by Assyrians, and to the present time? The Samaritans believed that their faith and their forms were more authentic and better because it could trace a longer history. The Jews believed that their faith and their forms were better because it was closer to the Mosaic regulations and laws. The Samaritans didn't think so because the Jewish worship in Jerusalem had been interrupted, whereas the worship on Mount Gerizim had not been, even through the Assyrian conquest. Jesus' response to the woman answers the question, but in a very different way. His response is that there's a better way, in keeping with John's replacement theme in his gospel account. Jesus tells the woman that both the Jewish and Samaritan beliefs about worship are about to be superseded by something that is newer and better. And that time has, in fact, arrived. Now, Jesus, in his response, does provide a parenthetical reference to the Jewish forms as being closer in revealing Yahweh than the Samaritan's form of worship. But nevertheless, he states that it doesn't really matter because both are on their way out. The Jews and Samaritans were obsessed with the location and forms of worship. Jesus is saying that they're really not that important when compared with what is truly important. Jesus tells us that what is truly important is that people worship God in spirit and truth. Worship is not so much about where, when, and what it looks like, but it is all about a person's heart relationship to God. Worship is about opening our hearts to God. Worship is being honest about ourselves to God. It is being honest about ourselves to ourselves and honest about ourselves to those around us by not pretending to be someone who we are not. God is seeking, Jesus tells us, people whose hearts are open to Him. And when he finds people like that, their worship is pleasing to Him and He draws near to them. Worship in spirit and truth can also be described as our attitude of complete dependence upon God, as something that involves our entire being, our heart, head, feelings, and bodies. We should also note that the context in which Jesus discusses worship is that of living water. And so true worship is something that is living and dynamic and growing rather than stagnant. And I think it sometimes helps to define something by what it isn't. Worship isn't a performance in which we try to do things that are acceptable to God, nor is it defined by a routine or tradition that people go through. This quote is from a commentary on the passage that we're discussing right now. It reads, "Fleshly or false worship would be pretending to be someone or something we are not, displaying prejudice toward others who are also made in God's image, practicing self-righteousness by denying our constant need for God's mercy and grace, worshiping in ignorance or superstition without knowing the reality for ourselves, and blindly worshiping out of habit with no heartfelt devotion." King David, too, understood true worship millennia before Christ. This is Psalms 51, verses 16 and 17, reading again from the Message. "Going through the motions doesn't please you. A flawless performance is nothing to you. I learned God worship when my pride was shattered. Heart-shattered lives, ready for love, don't for a moment escape God's notice." If we are to truly worship God, Jesus tells us that we must worship Him in spirit and truth. If we are relying upon our traditions and routines of worship, not that they are bad in and of themselves, but if we rely on them to do something for us, then are we really worshiping? Could we even make an idol out of the act of worship? When reading through the many examples of worship in the Bible, both in the Old and New Testaments, what I find is many different manners in which worship is expressed. So, could we perhaps become more free in how we express our worship? When worshiping, is our expectation to get something out of it? Do we worship because it's something we think we have to do, or do we worship because we want to? If our reasons for worshiping are faulty, then we likely are not worshiping in spirit and truth. And worship can become a performance for those around who we think are watching us. And once worship becomes a performance, it can soon lead to becoming a burden. Now, even though a person really doesn't want to go to church, they do it anyway because they feel like they have to keep up appearances. They go and make polite talk with others, but they don't really want to speak much with anyone because cracks might appear in their masks. They're not really interested in having more people come and join them because why in the world would anyone want to join them in their misery? This is pretending, a definition of hypocrite. It's Sabbath morning once again, and you decide to go visit another church. This one is a bit of a drive, about half an hour. It's located in farm country. As you approach it, you notice that the structure is well worn. Even with what looks like new paint, you can tell that it was built quite a while ago. From the looks of it, you guess that there's a small sanctuary and a few other rooms. The parking lot is packed dirt, and as you drive into it, dust kicks up all around. You see several vehicles, most of them of somewhat older vintage. And you missed a few turns getting here, so you're about 15 minutes late. As you approach the front door, a friendly smile on an older woman's face greets you. She guides you to the guest book, and she waits as you place your name in it. She hands you a basic bulletin, then asks if you would like to be led to the Sabbath school class. You respond yes, and she leads the way. As you go through the building, she points out where the restrooms are located, the pastor's office, and briefly describes who he is. She opens the door to a room, and as the people seated inside look over, she introduces you to the class. This class takes a few moments to introduce themselves as you take your seat. The discussion is lively and engaging, and it is all too soon time to move into the worship. One of the class members invites you to sit with him during this worship time. As you move through the hallway into the sanctuary, he introduces you to several other members. The order of service is familiar, though perhaps a bit more abbreviated than what would happen in a larger church. You notice that the people are not just simply staring blankly towards the front, but rather they seem more engaged, even during the sermon. A couple comes in a bit late, but there are no disapproving looks. The person up front pauses to acknowledge and welcome these members. You note that the service is not at all what you would consider a professional presentation quality, but there is something there, something here that was absent from the church you visited a week ago. These members seem okay if something doesn't go quite so perfectly. They're okay in talking about things deeper than the weather and the garden. They're talking about things going on in their lives. Interruptions by children and by adults don't seem to be much of a problem. There seems to be a genuine interest in caring about one another. The worship time comes to a close, and as people exit, it seems like nearly everyone comes to greet you and invite you to return again. A couple come up to you and invite you home for lunch. And as you enter your car to follow this couple, you ask yourself, would I return? Should I return? Now, don't get me wrong. I don't mean to imply that all big churches are bad and that all small churches are good. And I'm being a little bit more than stereotypical here to make the point that we are a small church. And my hope and prayer is that we would be like the small church that I just described. A church where the true spirit of worship can be experienced. I believe that when people that make up a church learn to worship God in spirit and truth, God's love and grace bubble up and naturally overflow like a spring and fountain to others. And I believe that this is what people are looking for today. A group of people that are genuinely loving and caring, where masks aren't needed, where God can be experienced without a performance. And I want to encourage all of us to continue our own individual spiritual growth so that we can become more and more like that. Let's be the kind of people in church that God is seeking for Himself.